space time, you have to be there on the dot. Well, welcome to Wofley Parish Church and our fourth annual Lady Day lecture. Even today, many of the commercial contracts that govern property and land transactions have their settlement date as Lady Day, one of the four quarter days of the old commercial year. The legal agreement even with our church wardens that they have with a farmer for their 11-acre field has two dates in the year when the rent becomes due, Lady Day and Michaelmas, September the 24th. We hold these events because of our commitment under the lottery-funded project to secure our tower from the depredation of the years. A gang of masons in the 16th century jacked up the tower to its present height. I wonder, when they had finished, whether they stood up there one dark night and beheld the array of the cosmos. Doubtless they would have seen a breathtaking panoply of stars, not like we can today, because we do so well at glazing over the view with our modern lighting. But today we have a very special guest who commands the wealth of modern technology that lies in the hands of the astrophysicists. He has seen things those 16th century masons never had an idea of. Professor Martin Barstow will no doubt reveal some snippets, but first, the credits. Martin Barstow is the Professor of Astrophysics and Space Science at Leicester University, but he wears two other hats. He's the Director of the Leicester Institute of Space and Earth Observation, and he's Pro Vice Chancellor, Big Boss, for strategic science projects at the university. We are in for a treat. Ladies and gentlemen, Professor Martin Barstow.
Well, thank you very much for that nice introduction, and I just hope I can live up to it. And it's a real pleasure to be here. I hadn't heard of the Lady Day lectures before. I think it's a fantastic idea, and it's particularly nice to be giving a lecture in such a beautiful church. I feel very much at home here because the layout is quite like Cosby Parish Church, particularly with the nice rood screen and the organ, which is what I'm normally sitting at, hiding behind it, where you can't really see the organist from the rest of the church, which makes me feel very safe. But I'm actually talking about science in the main here today, although I'll happily talk about other things at the end in a question and answer session if you want me to. And I was asked to talk about what has space done for us. This is a topic, as you might imagine, quite close to my heart, partly because if you're working in this area, people see space as an expensive, big-ticket activity, and it certainly isn't cheap. So a lot of questions get asked, so why should we spend money doing this? You know, if you're going to build a satellite at the cost of $100 million, well, I could build a couple of hospitals for that. And certainly it's important that we talk about those things and think about why we should spend fairly significant amounts of money living and working and operating in space and building satellites. So I think it's a really useful debate. And part of what I'm trying to do is answer that question. But also give an introduction to the wonderful things that we can do by adopting our space technology. As I've gone through over the years, I found this rather nice video clip, which I think says a lot about why we should go into space.
They let us wipe out bastards. They take everything we own. And not just from us, from our fathers, and from our fathers' fathers.
And from our fathers' fathers' fathers.
Yeah.
And from our fathers' 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 fathers.
You're right, Stan, don't labour the point. And what have they ever given us in return?
The aqueduct.
What?
The aqueduct.
Oh, yeah, they did give us that. That's true, yeah.
And the sanitation.
Oh, yeah, the sanitation, Reg. Remember what the city used to be like?
Yeah, all right, I'll grant you, the aqueduct and sanitation are two things the Romans have done.
And the roads.
Well, yeah, obviously the roads. I mean, the roads go without saying, don't they? But apart from the sanitation, the aqueduct and the roads...
Irrigation. Medicine.
Mm-hmm. Education. Yeah, all right, fair enough.
And the wine.
Yeah, that's something we'd really miss, Reggie, the Romans left.
Public baths.
And it's safe to walk in the streets at night now, Reg.
Yeah, they certainly know how to keep order. Let's face it, the only ones who could in a place like this.
All right, but apart from the sanitation, the medicine, education, wine, public order, irrigation, roads, the fresh water system and public health, what have the Romans ever done for us?
Brought peace?
Oh, peace! Shut up!
So, if I can take the liberty of editing the famous Monty Python clip, what has space done for us? And that's what I'm going to try to answer this morning, that particular question. The starting point, I think, for space exploration has always been very little to do with practical application. And this is a rather beautiful image. It's actually a real picture. It's not photoshopped. Taken across one of the US deserts, you'll see Monument Valley and the background of stars. And it's the wonder of the universe, actually, that's driven a lot of where we've got to today through astronomy and space science. And that motivation to explore has been one of the things that challenges human beings to do difficult and exciting things. But there are a number of practical reasons why we might want to go into space. If you try to distill it down to justification, as it were, one of these is politics. Many of us will remember the space race. I do. I'm old enough. And that time during the 1960s of great excitement when the USA and the USSR were competing to be the first people to reach the moon. And that was a very strong motivation, perhaps not necessarily a very good one, but certainly drove forward a lot of technology at the time and put us in the position that we are at the moment in terms of our ability to travel in space and to launch things outside the atmosphere. Then there's exploration, the science bit that I was talking about, the vastness of the universe. Closer to home, it's about finding out about the solar system. We live on a pretty fragile planet. That's one small piece of a number of planets and bodies in the solar system. Are we the only place where life exists? Important question that we would like to answer. The other thing about space, it's a good vantage point. Not just for looking out at the universe, which is kind of the obvious thing. You build a telescope, you put it in space. So Hubble Space Telescope spent 25 years plus looking out into the universe, gaining fantastic information about things in the distant throes of our own galaxy and further out. It's also a good place for looking down at the Earth. If you're standing on the surface of the Earth, you have a fairly limited horizon, obviously. And if you're trying to collect information about large areas, it's really rather difficult to do. If you put your instrument in space and look down, you can see large parts of the surface of the Earth all at once. And also, you can view it, except for cloud cover, which sometimes gets in the way, more or less continuously. And that gives you a lot of powerful information, particularly about things like climate change and global warming. And most of the evidence for the global warming comes from space data. And perhaps last but not least, and this comes back to the little debate about shall we build a satellite or shall we build a hospital, we actually contribute enormously to the economy. So when we invest in space, we actually get an enormous financial return for UK PLC in terms of income from taxes and also practical benefits from paying people to work in the space industry, developing supply chains, and actually generating real income that we can spend on other things. So I'm going to start with the political element. Some of you will probably know some of the history. You lived through it like I did. But actually, the space race really goes back much further than you might imagine. Last year, we celebrated the 60th anniversary of the launch of Sputnik 1, the first artificial satellite into orbit around the Earth. And that's clearly an important anniversary. But actually, space activity started during the Second World War in a rather painful way through the creation of the V2 rocket, which was one of Hitler's weapons of mass destruction, the successor to the V1. But what was different about the V2 is that the V2 was a genuine space rocket. It was fired into space outside the atmosphere on a parabolic trajectory, and then it would re-enter the atmosphere and target some place in the UK generally, but also France and Belgium and Holland were also targets for the V2 rocket. And something like 2,500 V2 rockets were flown during the Second World War at targets for the Western Alliance, which is perhaps many more than people actually think. The important thing is for us is that they weren't very accurate. So you could fly a V2, but actually hitting something with it was really pretty difficult, which was a good thing. And actually the real potency of the weapon was more through fear and terror, because you couldn't hear them coming. They were supersonic. So if you could hear a V2, you knew it hadn't hit you, and you didn't hear it if it was going to, which is why these things are really frightening as weapons of war. And the fact that perhaps we don't know quite how many were fired towards us is partly due to the UK government wanting to keep a lid on that, and make sure that that terror part of the weaponry wasn't really effective. And it certainly wasn't, fortunately for us. But it was the Russians that ultimately turned this weapon into something more politically important through its ability to put satellites into space. And this is a film of the launch of the Sputnik 1 mission.
Четвертый день весь мир был поражен успехами советской науки и техники. Наша ракета достигла невиданной скорости.
Sorry, some of you may understand the Russian. I don't, so I can't translate for you. Interestingly, the Russians don't count down. Everybody has got used to this idea from the NASA coverage, you know, 10, 9, 8, etc. to launch. The Russians don't do that, I noticed. I was out in Kazakhstan for Tim's Peak launch, and all you hear every sort of 30 seconds or so is a little status update, which is a sort of just a line in Russian that I can't understand, which is something like saying launch nominal. And you hear this every 30 seconds, and then all of a sudden it goes. It's an interestingly different philosophy. Certainly removes some of the drama, I think, with not having a countdown. And if you're waiting there to take a photograph, it's a bit of a challenge because you don't actually know when to set your video running or point your camera. But politically, this had enormous impact on the United States, because for the first time, there was this fear that the Russians could actually target the mainland of the United States because they could put something into space, and it's relatively easy to deorbit something and bring it down to the ground somewhere where you might want to target something. Actually, the Russians didn't really have that capability, but in the heads of the Americans, this was something to be feared. And so this was really the start of the space race. There was a huge push in the United States to develop rockets so that they could launch satellites and launch people into space as well, and compete with the Russians to essentially cancel out whatever superiority they were perceived to have.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing.
And this is a very
famous
speech.
Not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best.
I always look at the guy immediately to the right of Kennedy's shoulder.
Because that challenge
he's obviously got streaming cold. He's picking his nose and he's caught on camera forever.
And the others too.
You can also tell it was a different era because he was smoking a very big, thick cigar, which is probably why his nose was running, I think. But that's an iconic speech, joking apart, and really set the scene for this great drive from the USA to actually get human beings into orbit around the Earth and ultimately out to the moon. So what was going on in the UK? Well, actually quite a lot. If you actually go out and say, has the UK got a space program? A lot of people will say, no, we haven't. Actually, we've had a space program for almost 60 years. And you might be surprised to know that a lot of that space program started here in Leicester. When one of my close colleagues, the guy on the left, that bottom right picture, called Ken Pounds, came to Leicester from University College London and set up the X-ray astronomy group at the university. Interestingly, Ken is still one of the most productive scientists in our group. He comes into work every day, despite the fact that he's retired twice over the years. If that's what retirement looks like, I think my wife needs to be worried. And she does keep pointing this out to me as I get nearer to my own official retirement in the university. So we started space research in 1960 using rockets, not very different to the V2, somewhat different shape because there are better ways to do it, but the basic technology is the same. It's a big firework with a lot of fuel in it, and you light it, and over the course of about 20 or 30 seconds, you get enough velocity into the payload at the sharp end to get it up above the atmosphere. But these rockets don't put things into orbit. You don't get enough speed to get into orbit. And a lot of our research was done through what are these sounding rockets, where you build an instrument, you throw it up outside the atmosphere, and you get 5 minutes of data before the whole thing comes back again. And if you're lucky, the parachute opens and you get your instrument back in one piece. Very important way of developing technology for satellites, and it's something that we've actually been doing till relatively recently to test new instruments. So I last flew a sounding rocket in 2008, which is really not that long ago. But this led through a whole series of developments, and in the 1990s we started to develop this idea that actually looking down at the Earth would be quite a good idea. And the UK started something called its Earth Observation Programme, and Leicester was one of the first universities to start doing this work among a group of carefully selected universities around the UK. We moved on to Mars exploration, and we got the Queen's Award for our work in space and astronomy in 1994, one of the first Queen's Awards to universities in the country. We built a space research centre. And we had the idea for creating the National Space Centre, which I hope you've all visited. So if you haven't visited it, you can put your hands up now, and I will grab each and every one of you at the end and make sure that you do. So who hasn't? But if anybody has been there, you'll realise what a success it's been. At the moment, it brings in 300,000 visitors a year. And 80,000 of those are school groups who visit and encouraged into science and technology education. So we're very proud of that success. But it's also been an economic contributor because they employ a couple of hundred people down there, and that's jobs and people spending money in our beautiful city. So I think that's certainly one spin-off from space that we can point to. And during that 58 years, we've been involved in many space missions. I don't know if there's a laser pointer on here. There is, but it's not working. Never mind. I just wave my hands like Magnus Pike. Anybody remember Magnus Pike from the 1970s? I was talking to a few younger people last week, and they hadn't got a clue who Magnus Pike was, which made me feel quite old. But we've built many satellites over the years. I'm not going to talk about all of them because that would take most of the lecture. But actually, I'll just point out things that we're doing now. So, for example, on the bottom line there, the JWST, that's the James Webb Space Telescope, the successor to Hubble, on which we are providing an instrument that's now being tested. And the whole of that telescope, the biggest telescope ever to go into space when it flies in about 18 months' time, is contributions from Leicester, from other parts of the UK, and from Europe, as well as NASA, who are actually leading the mission. We're also going to Mars. We're working on an ExoMars mission, which will go in about 2020. Quite exciting for us is the BepiColombo mission. Although it's at the end there, it's actually going to be launched first. It's going to be launched in October this year, and that's going to go and study the surface of Mercury. However, it takes 7 years to get there, which is a bit counterintuitive. It's actually harder to get to Mercury than it is to get to Mars or Jupiter. Even though it's closer to us, it's the problem of going close to the Sun, but also you speed up so much as you approach the Sun that slowing down is really tough. So you have to travel via various planets, a couple of times around the Earth, a couple of times around Venus, to take that speed off so that you can actually go into orbit around Mercury and not crash. So let's talk about a technology. So what is space about? It's not about non-stick pans. Who thought it was? Yes, I'm glad some people are prepared to admit it. I think we should give them a round of applause. Because I thought it was as well for a long time, if I'm honest about it. But actually, Teflon is an invention of DuPont Company and was produced in the mid to late 40s. However, Teflon is used in space because it's a very smooth surface. And actually, you can use it as a lubricant. It's not a liquid lubricant, but you can put it into mechanics and it will allow metal surfaces to move easily across each other if you make a very thin Teflon ring or spacer. So Teflon is important to space because in space you can't use normal lubricants like oils and greases because they just evaporate and disappear. And worse than that, when they evaporate, they coat important sensitive parts of your instrument and stop it working, which is even worse. So Teflon is useful, but it's not what came out in the space program. But what we did get, well, we learned how to put things in space. We know how to build rockets. We got, every country or agency has got a suite of launch vehicles designed for doing different things. And now, as you will have seen in recent times, that commercial launch operators like Elon Musk and SpaceX and Blue Horizons and Blue Origin and things, they're beginning to do it for themselves and creating a commercial market around launch services and bringing the cost of getting to space down. We have satellites. We learned how to miniaturize electronics. Anybody got a mobile phone? I've got a mobile phone. It's in my pocket, my coat. That's a real miniaturized package of bits and pieces of chips and transistors and things. And it's the space industry that actually drove that miniaturization because it's so costly to get things into space. You have to make things as small as absolutely possible and as light. We got a lot of innovation, and the UK space industry is now worth £12 billion a year, which is a big part of industry as a whole. And when people say we don't make things, well, we do make stuff that goes into space. We do manufacture satellites and all the components that go into them. So it's an important part of the UK's industry. And we've been working over the last few years on something that we call the case for space, because the recognition that space is important has been very slow in coming. And so the space industry and academics in space have had to get together and write documents and papers that we've put into government and say, look, don't ignore the space industry. It's actually one of the biggest assets you have. And over the last 6 or 7 years, government have got it, because the predicted benefits from space are enormous. We're expecting that over the next 5 to 6 years, the space industry globally will grow to 1.1 trillion euros. Which is absolutely enormous. And even if you have a small part of that, and actually we want a big part of it, that is a huge amount of income to the economy. So when we're worrying about the UK economy, particularly at the moment, as we struggle to understand what's going to happen when we leave the European Union, and I'm not going to make any political comments about that, but practically speaking, we've got a job on to make sure that we protect our economy and that we put ourselves in a position to compete in this larger world. And space is a way of doing that. And you can see how that message has got through, because space is part of the industrial strategy. And you might have noticed last week that the space bill got assent. What does the space bill mean? Space bill means that we can actually build launch sites on the mainland of the UK and operate rockets from UK airspace, which we've never been able to do. And that's really important in terms of giving us a platform, as it were, for getting our products out into orbit and generating more activity. So I'm going to stick with the industrial theme just for a little while. And there are a number of parts to space as an economic driver that we call upstream. Upstream is the stuff we build and we put in orbit around the planet. Downstream is the stuff that we get that's a benefit from having satellites in orbit. And everybody in this room probably benefits from the downstream. So what is downstream? So who's got a mobile phone? Yeah. Has your mobile phone got GPS? Locator? A lot of you will have GPS location, or if not on your phone, in your cars. The GPS system is a suite of about 50 satellites that are permanently in orbit around the Earth. And from any point on the ground, So if we're outside, it doesn't really work inside a building like this, but when you go outside, you can see about, metaphorically, because they're too small to see, but your GPS detector in your phone or in your car can detect six of those satellites. They're above the horizon at any one time. And they use those satellites to get a fixed position. And that's how GPS works. If those satellites were degraded in any way, maybe from a solar storm that stopped them working, or they just broke down on their own, which does happen, so we have spares up there and move them into position when any of these satellites break down, you would not be able to operate your GPS. That would have an enormous effect on our economy, because all the transport system, particularly the commercial transport system, roads, rail, and air, rely on that. So that's a very important benefit. Another part of downstream is that a lot of the satellites that are in orbit are producing data. I'm sure most of us will have looked at the weather forecast last night on BBC or ITV News to see whether we needed to put a coat on this morning, whether we're going to get wet walking here or driving here. That is space data. Pretty much all of it now. It's satellite images that are examined and recorded in real time, so you can see weather systems moving around. That helps you predict where they're going to go. So the accuracy of our weather forecast is very much dependent on data. Space-enabled is what we would call spin-off. So everybody thinks about spin-off in space. Without, like the Teflon, wasn't really spin-off. Nor was Velcro, as it happens, but it was used in space. But we do actually get interesting and important things from the technology that we developed to put in space. So let me come back to the mobile phone analogy. Rick's nodding there. He hasn't got GPS in his phone. Have you got a camera in your phone, Rick? Oh, gosh. Really low tech. But most of us, except for Rick, will have a camera in our phone. Sorry to single you out. The chip in that phone is a miniaturized, something called a CCD, charge coupled device. That CCD was developed to go into space, actually at Leicester. We worked on those CCDs in the late 70s and early 80s to develop those sensors for astronomical telescopes. And then the industry that made those things started to mass produce them so you could put them in cameras and phones. So that's a spin-off from the space that you probably have never even thought about. And I'll talk a little bit about more of these in a minute. We have a big satellite and spacecraft industry in the UK. We have Airbus, a couple called Thales Alenia Space, and Lockheed Martin. Actually, Lockheed Martin is originally American, but they now have a presence in the UK and a UK arm. And those are companies that we're working with in Leicester in particular. And they're at the forefront of trying to develop new ideas of lowering costs of access to space that we're actually going to put in the space park that we plan to build down next to the National Space Centre. We have companies that work in what we call subsystems, so they build bits of spacecraft that you take and bolt on, and software. Software is really important. How do you control your spacecraft? How do you operate the systems when they're in space? And there's lots of things now around spin-out and services. I talked about GPS, but weather forecasting. Also, agriculture is an important service. I've got some more detail about these a bit later. So this is an interesting slide that I always like to use. The problem with this slide is that I can never quite remember which way around the images are, because the left-hand image and the right-hand image were taken by the same camera, absolutely exactly the same device, except one was on a telescope in space and one was in a hospital. So if you look at the image on the left, that's something called a supernova remnant. On the right is something called a supernova remnant. And that's an explosion of a star that throws out gas and dust into space, and it's many, many light years across when it eventually fades away. At the moment, that remnant is about one light year across, and it's probably about 1,000 light years away from us. That was recorded with an X-ray telescope that we built as part of a European consortium. On the left, the same device is actually in a specialist imaging system in the Queen's Medical Centre in Nottingham, and is used to detect X-rays from iodine-125 in cancer tumours. So the same technology that we use to do astronomy also helps people recover from cancer on the ground by allowing us to monitor things early and giving them much lower doses of radiation than we used to have to do in the past. And also, what you get is much more detail. So when people are operating, if they want to remove these tumours, they have much more precise information about where the tumour is located and make sure that they can get the whole thing during that operation. Another example is, before I move on, the device on the left in that big case is the actual imager that we produced for the Queen's Medical Centre. And that's an image of the camera before it was installed in there. Another spin-off, which is similarly from this space telescope technology, is something called a mini gamma-ray camera. The mini gamma-ray camera is a handheld device. The bottom right is a prototype that we developed. And on the top right is what we've now produced from the spin-out company that we set up to actually market this technology. So this is something that you can take into a hospital in a hand. You can see it's about the size of a palm of my hand. And instead of having to take a patient to a massive scanner, which is expensive, it's actually not very pleasant for the patient. If you've ever had the misfortune to have to use an all-body scanner, you realize it's very noisy. And it's very, very confined. And if you've got any claustrophobia, it's a very unpleasant experience. But the handheld gamma camera can be just taken to a hospital bed and used to locate tumours for operation. So it speeds up the process. It actually makes it much less unpleasant, although being ill is never a pleasant thing to be, but also improves dramatically the potential outcomes for patients. And I already talked about satellite navigation. This is a schematic that shows those satellites in orbit around the Earth. And you see they're always transiting a part of the Earth. So you have to have a large constellation to cover the whole planet to make sure you can see enough of these satellites at any one time. And the blue dot is essentially where we are on this schematic, and it's telling you how many of those satellites are visible to actually do the satellite navigation. You need a minimum of about 6, but it's better to have more because that improves the accuracy. And the weather. There's been a lot of weather around recently. The beast from the east and all that. And how did we know the beast from the east was coming? From an image like that, that could see the weather patterns forming. And then by watching those weather patterns, you can predict. Obviously not, it's not 100% accurate, but it's much more accurate than it used to be. And you can predict those weather patterns. Actually, during the course of that bad period of weather, I think they got those predictions pretty much spot on about the amount of snow that was going to fall and where it was going to fall. And that helps people plan what they're going to do. And if you know you're going to get 12 inches of snow, well, then you don't plan to drive halfway across the country. But if you know that you're not, then you can carry on with your daily business. This is also about imaging the Earth, but perhaps a bit more serious than just weather. Space data also allows us to monitor what's going on in a more serious way. Something we call space situational awareness, which is using space assets to understand what's going on, for example, in disaster zones. So on the far left, I don't know if anybody remembers this. I'm going to leap over and point out the UK. So if you can just see the yellow is tracing out the United Kingdom, and you see these highlighted orange areas. I wonder if anybody can guess what this data is. Yes. So if you remember the unpronounceable volcano a few years ago in Iceland, there's Iceland. Spewing out dust that was dangerous for aircraft. So although it was a tricky situation at the time and a lot of aircraft had to be grounded, the important thing is that satellite data could track the dust and tell you where it was. So although it all came as a bit of a shock and a surprise, it was because we had satellite data that we were able to gradually get aircraft back up in the air, because we could map out where the danger zones were and make sure that any flight paths were able to avoid those. Obviously, if any of that comes right over your airport, that's the end. You can't fly at all. But it does mean that you can manage the situation. And perhaps, in a sense, more serious, the images on the right are Fukushima. And the 2010 image is what Fukushima used to look like, and the 2011 image is what it looked like immediately after the tsunami that followed the earthquake. What that helps you do is understand how to target the relief effort, because you can't communicate with people on the ground in those circumstances. That kind of disaster completely wipes out all the infrastructure. So there's no power, no communications, you have no idea what's happening. So satellite data actually gives you immediate access to information about what's going on. You might only have to wait an hour or two before a satellite goes overhead, and you've got the information that you need. And that helps. It can't stop disasters, but it can certainly help the management and minimise the damage and minimise the loss of life by being able to get into the right areas with the right equipment. And perhaps the ultimate disaster, potentially, if we don't understand it and get round to doing something about it, is climate change. And climate change is one of the biggest issues that faces us. Perhaps not us in this room right now, in the sense of we probably won't be here to see the worst that it's going to bring. But it is happening now. The temperature is going up all the time. And unless we actually do something really quite dramatic over the next 10 to 20 years, it's going to be a disaster around the whole planet. This image is a measurement of sea surface temperature. It's something that groups in Leicester do on a regular basis. We've been monitoring sea surface temperature from space for about 30 years now, and we have a continuous and unbroken record of highly accurate temperature measurements taken every day across the whole surface of the Earth, particularly the oceans, which is where the oceans are very stable, so you have what you might loosely call less weather in the oceans, because they don't heat up and cool down very quickly. So ocean surface temperature is a really good way of measuring the whole temperature of the planet. And obviously you can see it's warmer near the equator and it's colder to the poles. But what this allows us to do is look at the patterns, see how global warming actually influences things. And this top right inset shows a couple of graphs of how snow cover is changing in the bottom, the global average sea level is varying in the middle, and the global average temperature is varying at the top. And I actually have to say I get extremely cross and upset when people say, oh, it's not happening. It is. The scientific, it doesn't matter what Donald Trump says, it doesn't matter what Donald Trump's minions say, it doesn't matter what the people in the oil industry say, this is real scientific evidence. The temperature is changing, and it's increasing in a way that it has never done in the history of our planet. And it's driven by us. That is an inescapable conclusion. We feed this data into the climate change panels, and all those reports that you hear about that come out of places like Paris and Kyoto is supported by this data. So there are other useful things that we can do with space data. And again, something that originates in Leicester, but is also applied more widely, is air quality. Anybody walked through Leicester recently, or particularly around the Ring Road, might have felt themselves choking quite a lot, because Leicester is one of the most polluted cities in the UK. It's not unique, because it's a common problem in cities, but the slow movement of traffic through Leicester is a particular problem. And if you look at the inset of that top panel, that is Leicester. And the red is the concentration of nitrous oxide. And you can see how it concentrates around the M1 on the left, and in the city centre and along the main arteries. So that's just a measurement.
What can we do about it?
Well, actually, what we can do is use it to help traffic control. if we change our algorithms and think about how traffic control should be optimised to minimise pollution, we might do some things which are quite different to the way we operate traffic lights throughout the city now. And also, how we might, we might stop certain types of vehicles coming into the city, because a lot of that pollution comes from diesel rather than petrol. So you might want to change the mix. Although the downside of petrol, it produces more CO2, which helps global warming. So it's a difficult balancing act that we have to do. But if we have the good data, then we can actually think properly about what the best things are to do. Are electric vehicles a solution? They may well be, but there are potential hidden costs around production of batteries for electric vehicles and dangerous waste at the end of those vehicles' lives from those batteries. So there's no simple solution. It's a question of balancing everything up and trying to work our way towards the best one. So we can monitor vegetation as well. Agriculture is really going to benefit from that. And here are some examples. Space data on the left is monitoring urban heat islands. So if you look down at that bottom picture, you can see where the red are. That's where all the heat's escaping. So you can actually work out from space who hasn't got loft insulation. It might sound a bit trivial, but actually, if you know who hasn't got loft insulation, you can get down there and target them and persuade them that they really ought to have it. And that's a contribution to saving energy and reducing the impact of our energy expenditure. Bottom right there is a big field. Well, okay, it's just a field. But you can see you can colour code the data from space and you can work out what vegetation is there. And if you can do that, you can improve your agricultural practices, particularly in remote areas where the ground infrastructure isn't so good as it is in this country. An important experiment that we've been doing recently is looking at forests in Kenya. Kenya is a third world country. It hasn't got great ground infrastructure, although it does have a political system and people there on the ground who desperately want to stop people burning their forests down. So we use space data. Everybody has a mobile phone, because mobile phone infrastructure is quite easy to put in. It's relatively cheap. And when we detect a fire, we send a mobile phone alert to the people in Kenya and telling them where the fire is, and therefore they can get there and they can stop it and put it out quickly before it creates too much damage. Similarly, in Brazil, we can pick up where forests are being cut down. Deforestation is a big problem in countries like Brazil. You can detect it quickly, and then you can get the people on the ground, in this case, the army, to go and make sure that those people are not cutting any more trees down, ever, potentially. So they're captured and they're hopefully locked up. But it's the ability to respond to things in remote regions that can be really important, actually for our planet, as much as for local economy. And maybe the ultimate thing we can do with space data is avoid the fate of the dinosaurs. So I don't know if you're aware that 63 million years ago, the dinosaurs were wiped out in a very short space of time. And as we understand it now from the archaeological and paleontological evidence that we have, is that there was a major impact in the Gulf of Mexico, creating a massive crater, which is now mostly under the floor of the ocean, but part of it is on land. And this impact was so large that it created a global winter lasting decades, if not hundreds of years. And that caused the collapse of the ecosystem, and the creatures at the very top, the dinosaurs that needed a lot of food supply, basically could not survive that period. It was probably also complicated by volcanism, which was triggered by the impact, rather than just the impact itself. So it wasn't instantaneous, impact hits, dinosaurs die. It was a change to the habitat that caused the extinction over a period of decades to hundreds of years. But in geological time, that is a really short space of time. The bottom picture is actually the Barringer crater, meteor crater in Arizona, which I visited it last year when I was at a meeting in Arizona. It is really spectacular. It doesn't look so much when you see it in a photograph like that, but when you actually walk up to the rim and you just see this, you can't capture it in a single camera shot. You have to do it in your sort of panorama. And that was impact was created by something about the size of Rothley. So a large asteroid, but that would have wiped out a lot of life, probably across the whole of North America at the time, in an instant. And there is a record of that. It was more than 10,000 years ago, but it completely sterilized large parts of North America at the time. So if we were to be hit by something like that, you can imagine the damage it would cause to our modern society with our high population densities. But we can look at these things from space and we can monitor and at least check all the objects that are around and see whether they're likely to hit the Earth. And if they are, we can make predictions about when that might be. And that gives us a chance to do something about it. And practically speaking, there are things that we could do to move a meteor away from a path that might cause us damage. So although it sounds a bit like Bruce Willis and all that, deep impact, it is actually technologically feasible for us to prevent something like the impact that wiped out the dinosaurs. But we do need a bit of warning. And actually, the early warning is part of what we're doing right now with our telescopes in space. So I'm getting close to the end. So I think that's the practical benefits. And I hope I've convinced you that it's really worth spending money on doing space because we actually get more back than we put in. And we can use that return to support other parts of our society. But of course, one of the reasons I started doing this in the first place wasn't because I wanted to make an economic impact, although I'm pleased to be able to do so in the work that I'm doing now. I started doing it because I wanted to know what was out there. I was a child of Apollo. I saw the men land on the moon. I watched Voyager launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base in 1977 on the TV. And I even worked on Voyager for a while. And for me, it was about exploration and understanding the universe and getting out into the planets. And the future for us is really healthy. As I said at the beginning, we're going to Mercury this year, arriving about 2025. So we have to be patient in this business. You know, if you want to send things to the deepest reaches of the solar system, you have to wait a while. And it's often the case that people like me, we build stuff, and we don't ever see the benefit from it. We're doing it for the next generation of scientists, because we will have retired by the time things get there. ExoMars, I think, is a particularly exciting mission for LESTA. It's a European Space Agency mission, which will put a rover on Mars in 2020. But what's really exciting for us is the development of an instrument to search for life on the planet. Searching for life on a remote object is a hard thing to do. The Viking missions tried that in the 1970s, and they thought they had detected life, but you have to be sure that that's the only answer to the measurement. And scientists went away and said, well, can we reproduce this measurement without the presence of life? And they were able to do that with non-organic reactions. So although the guy who built the experiment, who I met a few years ago, is absolutely, totally convinced there is life on Mars, 99% of scientists don't think that that is the answer at the moment. Doesn't mean to say it can't be. But that particular experiment produced an ambiguous result, and you can't claim there is life on Mars as a result. So refined experiments have been tested and tried over the decades since, and will culminate in ExoMars with one of the most sensitive sets of experiments designed to search for life on the planet yet. And unless somebody else manages to find a better way or a different way of reproducing our answer that doesn't require life, we might get that answer in a few years' time. I'm sure everybody knows about the Hubble Space Telescope. Hubble Space Telescope has been one of the most wonderful scientific instruments ever created by humans, without a doubt. It has spent now 28 years studying the universe, with bringing back fantastic pictures. I have to say, if it wasn't for the Hubble Space Telescope, I don't think my career would have been as exciting as it has been. And I might not have been as successful as I've been lucky enough to be in developing my career in Leicester. And I've used it for all that time. We're about to launch the James Webb Space Telescope. That's been a bit of a struggle. It's not now going to go this year because we've already heard there's going to be a launch delay. Because it's such a complex instrument, it's going to take longer than we had planned to do all the tests that we need to do before we actually put it into space. There's nothing wrong with it, but the schedule of testing has got longer and longer because we can't go and repair it. It's going out into the distant part of the solar system, well away from the Earth, where it's nice and cold and quiet. So we won't be able to send astronauts to fix it if something has gone wrong, like we did with Hubble. So we've got to get it right first time. These missions take decades to design. Hubble was first conceived in the mid-1960s, and it was finally launched in 1990. The timescale for things that are this challenging is enormous. James Webb Space Telescope was actually first thought about before Hubble was launched. That's the next step. And so if we want to have the next stage beyond James Webb, we have to be thinking about that now. And potentially, and this is not necessarily a mission that's been chosen yet, but we're working on the successor to the James Webb Space Telescope, which we're calling at the moment LUVOIR, which is short for Large UV Optical Infrared Telescope. And if we're successful in getting NASA to approve it, this probably will fly certainly not before 2030, but more likely in the mid-2030s when I will definitely have retired. So this is about long-term planning, something governments don't do very well, but actually scientists are really quite good at. So Hubble has a 2.4-metre mirror. So 2.4 metres, well, it's about a bit more than the height of a human being. James Webb Space Telescope has a 6-metre mirror. So James Webb Space Telescope would not fit inside this church with all its spacecraft structure. It's that big. So you've got to imagine a mirror that's about the height of the nave here. It is truly colossal. LUVOIR will have a 15-metre mirror. It would be absolutely colossal. Why does it have to be so big? The reason it has to be so big is that this is the telescope that will be designed to search for life around other planets in the galaxy, not in our solar system. But it will be sent out to study what we call exoplanets, extrasolar planets. We have been looking for planets around other stars for a long time. But until the mid-1990s, it was all science fiction. It was all Star Trek, Star Wars, which is great fun. But we never had the sensitivity to detect planets, because stars are big things. Planets, even the planet Jupiter, is less than 1% of the size of the Sun. And so if you're going to find a Jupiter around another star, you've got to have a very sensitive instrument to actually detect it. And in the 90s, we managed to develop the technology to do that. So we were able to detect many extrasolar planets. We now know of more than 3,000. So planets are common. Almost, yeah, pretty much every star has a family of planets, at least one planet. And we've even been able to detect them directly. In the Hubble image there, which is a star called Beta Pictoris, where we block the light from the star with something called a coronagraph, so we can image the very faint dust that orbits the star. And that's what astronomers were looking for. They were just studying the dust and how the dust changed. And then they realized that there was a little dot of light, and that little dot of light was moving very steadily through their images as they went back and got more images. And that is a planet. It's the first directly imaged planet outside our own solar system. And the race is now on to find what we call Earth-like planets. And what do we mean by Earth-like? We mean planets that are about the same size as the Earth, about the same position in their planetary system, because the Earth is actually quite unique. If it was much closer to the Sun, we couldn't survive. If it was much further away from the Sun, we couldn't survive. So there's something called what we call the habitable zone in any planetary system, where the radiation from its parent star is about right, and that allows liquid water to exist on the surface of that planet. And in fact, liquid water can only exist on the surface of the Earth in our entire solar system, except for had a slight blank moment, but the largest moon of Saturn, which the name has just slipped out of my head, but because that has a thick atmosphere. But even then, most of the water on that surface is frozen. Titan. I knew it would come back to me. So if we want to find something the size of the Earth, so we know lots of planets the size of Jupiter, there are lots of planets the size of Neptune, we have to build a really big telescope and improve the sensitivity. And that's why Louvois is going to be so large. We've looked at technologies for an 8-metre mirror, but the problem with the 8-metre mirror is it doesn't allow us to find enough Earth-like planets to go and look for evidence of life. So Louvois will be large, it will be in deep space where it's very quiet and where there's not much background radiation to interfere. And the aim is to take images. So this is a simulation of an image. If Louvois was looking at the solar system at a distance of about 10 light years, this is what it would see. So you could detect Earth, you can detect Venus, just you can't detect Mars because it's too faint. You notice it's missing from that image, but Mars isn't bright enough. And you can't detect Mercury because you can't get close enough into the Sun to detect Mercury with this telescope. But it does give you a lot of space to look for planets. And the number of exo-Earths that we predict scales by the aperture, because the aperture allows you to zoom in closer into the star. It also makes you more sensitive. So a 16-metre telescope, we predict, we'll see about 60 Earth-like planets over the course of a few years and be able to detect those. And then once we've found them, we can then go back with the telescope and we can take a spectrum. And the spectrum is what we the smoking gun. So if you get a spectrum of the Earth, you'll see it's full of many things that you don't see on any other object in the galaxy. You will detect ozone, you'll detect oxygen, you'll detect methane and carbon dioxide. And the relative proportions of those tell you about the processes that are going on in that planet. Oxygen is the real giveaway. Oxygen disappears from a planetary atmosphere very quickly unless something is putting it back. It's not stable. So Mars is red, isn't it? Well, that's where all the oxygen is. It's in rust. And I mean, literally, Mars is rusty because whatever oxygen existed on the planet has been locked up in the rocks through the processes that on this planet produce rust. So if you're sucking oxygen out all the time, and that would happen to this planet if we had no plant life, then you have to replace it. So if you detect large proportions of oxygen, that's pretty much a sure sign that there is life of some kind, can't tell you what it is, on the surface of that planet. And so if you ask me to come give you this talk in, where are we? So it's the 24th of March 2018, so maybe 20 years' time, 24th of March 2038, then I might be able to talk about this particular news article that declares the existence of the detection of the first Earth-like planet. It's an enormously challenging process, and it was require a lot of technological development, but we are actually very much on the cusp of being able to do it. And I would say that within the next 10 to 15 years, we will put a telescope in space that can do this and that will find the answer one way or the other. Thank you.